All right, welcome to the Ecclesia Leadership Podcast. This is episode number 11.
Episode number 12. We just clarified that too.
Yeah, I don't do numbers very well, John. You know that. Episode number 12. With me is John Chandler, as always. And John, do you want to say anything at all?
I am your corrector of all things inaccurate. And also, we never give away the date, but happy birthday.
Thank you. That's true. And then also with us is Tim Keel, who is the pastor at Jacob's Well in Kansas City. And why don't we do this? Why don't you say hi, first of all?
Hi, everybody.
There you go.
Great to be with you.
Well done.
So I'm guessing the people in Ecclesia have interacted with you on some level, but why don't you just give kind of like a brief your history, where you're at and what you're doing.
I'm, like you said, the pastor at Jacob's Well, and I started Jacob's Well with a small core of people in the late 90s. And pastored that church, had a blast, an amazing time doing that until 2009. And in 2009, I resigned and took a position at a theological college in New Zealand in Auckland called Laidlaw College, and was there for a little over a year and a half. Had an amazing journey relocating my family internationally. And then through a set of extraordinary circumstances, found myself coming back to Kansas City and reassumed a position in August 2011, and have been back with Jacob's Well since then, for the last year and a half.
Nice. So Jacob's Well was planted in 09, you said, right?
99. Yeah.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, we started as a core in 98, but we didn't start having public worship until fall 99.
So what, the first... Go ahead, go, John.
What were you doing prior to that?
Well... just prior to that, I was living in Denver. I had been a youth pastor in the early 90s and enjoyed that, but realized pretty quickly that that wasn't going to be a sustainable path for me, and decided to go to seminary, not certain what I wanted to do. And so moved my very young family at that point to Denver and went to seminary for 4 years. And at the kind of towards the end of that journey, through a number of different circumstances and relationships, just felt a calling to plant a church. And so that became a process of then determining where we thought we at that point might stay in Denver. I had a friend that was doing something in Seattle that looked like it might have the ability to turn into a church plant. But over the long haul, I just had a sense that Kansas City was the place that we were being called to. And that was we didn't expect to go back to Kansas City at that point. We had loved living in Denver and had a young family. But nevertheless, we felt called back to KC and came back and started. I think it was ended up being a great decision.
Yeah, it looks good from here.
Yeah.
When you planted with Jacob's Well, where did that core group of people come from? Were they relationships you had had before?
Yeah, we had about 35 people when we started, and we spent about a year kind of gathering that. The first year we just spent getting back in kind of relationship, moving back, relocating from Denver. And so we had three kind of major areas where people connected to us from. One was we had a parent church that gave us a platform for about 6 months to a year to connect. And so probably a third of the folks were connected to us through that church. And that's the church where I had been the youth pastor previously. Another third, I had been a campus ministry leader as an undergraduate student. And so a number of people were connected to me through the relationship that we'd had in college. And then another third were people that lived in the part of the city where we were planning, and they were mostly unchurched people, Christians that didn't want to drive to the suburbs to go to church. We were planting a church in a part of the city where there wasn't a lot of kind of super vibrant churches at the time. And so when we started planning, a bunch of people were just neighborhood people that were committed to the city and wanted to be a part of a faith community that was in the city. So that's kind of the three major spheres where folks came from.
And is Jacob's Well independent, or do you have some kind of denominational background or anything?
No, we're independent. When we started, our parent church was then connected to a young denomination, the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, but they were in the process of withdrawing from that denomination, and we spent a year trying to discern if we wanted to be connected or not. And at the time, we just made the decision to be independent. The denomination was pretty young and going through some pretty challenging fights, and we didn't want to necessarily expend energy doing that kind of work. And so we didn't, I don't think, thought we were going to be independent forever, but as it progressed, it just didn't seem to ever make sense relationally to connect beyond ourselves.
Yeah. So, you know, just in terms of practicality, was there funding that came along from the church?
No.
Well, how did you guys play that out?
Yeah, we didn't have a lot of funding. I think we had $10,000 a year for 3 years from the parent church, and that's the funding that we ever had, and that basically covered a tiny bit of my salary and my family's health insurance for those first 3 years. So we grew slowly, and particularly as it related to finances, we pretty quickly started articulating financial stewardship as a part of what it meant to live a surrendered worship life. And so our community, I mean, really early on, for a church plant, tithed like crazy. We were able to just grow slowly, and I think we struggled a little bit initially because that meant putting a lot of responsibility on a few people. We didn't hire a lot, but at the same time, we were able to develop a pretty healthy savings account, and that was significant because when we had the opportunity to buy the building that we were renting from the parent congregation in the city, who's parent, not the church that planted us, but the church that was hosting us in the city, when they had to close their doors about 4 years later, we were able to negotiate a good price and buy the building
nice.
From them and never have debt. We've never had debt as a congregation, so that's been amazing.
Yeah. So was your – you said that Jacob's well paid part of your salary. What was the – you just kind of eat a lot of macaroni and cheese or –
confusing. The church that helped to plan us donated $30,000.
Oh, okay.
Over. In those initial startup years, that $1,000 a year kind of helped.
Gotcha.
Supplement the salary the church was paying me.
Gotcha.
Sorry, about three different kind of things there. So.
Yeah, and you're starting to cut out a little bit, actually. John, are you hearing the same thing?
One little bit.
I think it's Skype actually. Never mind. We can cut this part out. But So as you guys have gone through, like, what are the like, you know, as a church grows, like, you have like kind of different mark points along the way, right? Like, what were some of those significant markers for you as far as growth wise or organizational structure wise or like. Because you're one of the bigger churches that I would associate kind of with a lot of this missional, like, church plant type stuff that grew out of like the early emergent days. How has that journey been organizationally for you guys?
Yeah, it's been, I think, an adventure would be one way to describe it, because I think that we were focused pretty early on the more organism side of what it looked like to be a community. We were pretty organic and creative. We didn't have a lot of resources financially, and so administration wasn't our strong suit. Same, we had a lot of life. We had a young congregation, a lot of community. And so we kind of just kind of made it up as we went along, hiring staff as we could. Natural. In the first developing stages of a congregation's life, when there's no community there, oftentimes churches grow and people feel like they're connected if they feel like they have a relationship to the pastor. And that's sustainable to a point. And then you've got to start finding mechanisms for the church to begin to connect, not just to the pastor, but to have an identity that's both connected to people and their relationships to each other and people connected to mission. And so the way in which you decide to organize in that regard becomes pretty important. And so we made a move when we got to be about 150 to 200 to start kind of house churches to begin to get people into communities where they were worshiping and connecting to mission throughout the week, not just on Sundays, obviously. And we had a pretty broad spread from around the city. So initially we also connected to those of regions of our area. So obviously people, you know, house churches are funky. You've always got to honor the dynamics that you just can't force relationships. There's affinity or there's not. People feel like they're connected to others relationally or they don't. And so we tried to get people connected in neighborhood kind of situations, but also recognized that people had a lot of different ways to connect. And so we had like 8 to 12 community groups that were kind of functioning. And then as we continued to grow up around 350, 450 people, then we had to grow. And that included adding additional staff and beginning to think about some of those things. And some of those hires were good. Some of them were more challenging. Some of them didn't work out. And when you're a young church and you're growing like crazy, bad hires are really costly because you lose momentum. You're at a point where you need help. And Oftentimes, resources are not available, and that can be both money resources. It can also be people resources. You kind of grab what's at hand, try to what you have. And so I think as a leader, your energy is getting split between your responsibilities, leading a staff, leading a congregation. And so I think for those kind of...
Something's not working on Skype for a minute.
We lost you on that last one.
So let me just say this in terms of picking back up. I mean, I think, for example, I think that in the early days, there's a lot of the soft characteristics that help an organization, that help a church or a mission kind of grow. And that's related to personality and giftedness and vibe and whether or not people access the relational life early on. But as an organization both grows in terms of its the number of people that are wanting to participate, and then as it ages, if you only ever grow in the kind of organismal way or the organic ways, eventually the organization starts to be hobbled. It begins to struggle because there are organizational realities that eventually have to mature that will allow the life to expand. And so I think in those kind of middle years of our congregational's life, we struggled there. And I think resources are a big part of that. Both money really matters in some ways. It doesn't have to, actually it does. I mean, and in that regard, and then having access to people that are rightly slotted for the roles that you need to develop becomes pretty important too. And so I think in those middle years we struggled because we just needed we were struggling for resources and the right hires. And when something's a moving reality, there's just not time to stop. And so anyway,
were those struggles kind of like necessary struggles, or were those struggles you're like, wow, we could have really avoided some stuff?
That's a great question, Todd. And it's hard to know looking back because, you know, time affords you a perspective that you look back, you go, oh, yeah, I see where that could have gone differently. At the time, you're doing the best you have with what you have, you know. And I mean, and so I look back and go, yeah, there are some processes that we could have done differently. There are some things that we could have done a little differently. Again, I feel like some of the decisions we're making now that are good decisions come out of the lessons that we learned from making bad decisions, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wisdom comes by making mistakes and having to kind of live with the consequences of them.
Yeah.
So how do you coach that? Because certainly you have opportunities to talk with church planters. So you don't want to guide them. You don't want to guide them towards mistakes, but you don't want to guide them fully around them, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's really one of the things for me that now, John, that's a great question. And if I were to look back and start over, I think I would have been much more intentional about cultivating relationships with people beyond or outside our community that could have been conversation partners in that regard.
Yeah.
I'm coaching a couple guys right now and then have a couple relationships with leaders in the city that are either peers. And I find conversations with people that have gone a little bit ahead. I mean, this isn't, I mean, major revelation or anything, have been for me significant things. And I feel like in some of the relationships that I have coaching with other younger leaders, I've been able to help younger leaders navigate some of those things by just having conversation in that regard. I mentioned the fact that I lived in New Zealand. One of the things that's pretty common practice there that I've not seen in the U.S. is that you know, we have spiritual direction, we have counselors, but they do this thing there called supervision that across their culture, no matter what sector of the public life you're in, you've got somebody that you pay as a supervisor professionally as part of your ongoing professional development. So if you're a teacher, you've got it. If you're a CEO, you've got it. People just have professional relationships with older folks as part of standard practice. And I think that's pretty important to have not just a person, but like a constellation of people that you know how to access to grow and to continue to be able to bounce things off. It's not so much that someone tells you the right thing to do. It's that they help you kind of think through all the dynamics of what's going on.
Yeah. Got me thinking. So, you know, in the transition where you went from kind of more organic community to more organizational community,
Yeah.
There's obviously a shift in the ethos of your congregation and people's, like, how did you have to shepherd your people through that change, or is it just something they had to learn? How were they part of it?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say the culture shifted. In fact, I think that, you know, I think what's happened is our people struggled so that when we got the organizational support we needed, people were like, oh, thank you. You know, I mean, in other words, I think we still have the creative, organic. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of our DNA. It's not hard for us to do that. The piece was to add the support that allows that stuff to grow and expand. It's not a culture shift as much as it is to say we now have things in place that support better the life we already had. I wouldn't want to pose organism and organization as against one another. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's what I was. That's what I was. I didn't want to either. And that's helpful. That's really helpful. Yeah.
I mean, and so I don't think we've gone from having no organization to having organization. I think we've gone from having less helpful organization to more helpful organization, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Which I think is just health. I think that we want to be a healthy community. And that includes the ability to do things like communicate well, to give access to people to information that they need. You know, I mean, that's the world we live in today, that if you're not communicating well, bad communication or lack of communication makes people suspicious. You know what I mean? And so you want to include people with as much information as they need to feel like they're connected and apart.
Hmm. One of the, I'm not saying I'm going to say this, but I can imagine people have thought, well, you guys are so big. Mm. How could you really be a missional church? Cause you know, I mean, what's your membership at or
Well, yeah. So two things. One, membership is something that we're actually going to begin doing this year. We haven't formally had membership. And so for me, the idea that covenant is a way of belonging that's better than just association or being connected is really powerful. So we're actually in the process of considering membership. We in our database, we have about 1,600 people in our database. That includes children and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, so like I don't know, that might be the claim. Someone out there might say, "Well, you guys are too big to really be missional," quote unquote. And who knows what they mean by that? Like, do you get that? What would you say to that? Like, you know.
Well, I suppose that's out there.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. I think you guys are totally a sham, but
right. All smoke and mirrors.
Yeah,
yeah. I guess it depends on what the meaning of missional is, because I think there's been this association that if you're missional, you're unstructured, you're only in houses, and so to me, the idea of missional is how are we both personally and corporately participating in God's life in intentional ways, and so you know. I think that there are valid and legitimate questions to be asked of large organizations. I think there are equally valid and legitimate questions to be answered of small kind of home communities or missional communities. And so the question is what they are and what does faithfulness look like? I think we're trying as a community to understand and participate with the gospel as we kind of understand it. And that has to then get embodied in structures. So I don't know if I got around to your question there.
Maybe absolutely. Yeah, sure.
So Tim, tell us a little bit about. I mean, I know that you're involved with the Missio Alliance coming up, the event coming up, and when I stated that before we started, you were emphatically enthused about it.
I am. Yeah.
So. Yeah, I mean, so tell me a little bit about what is it about, because I know, you know, I mean, I first ran across you early in some of the emergent conversations, that kind of thing. So tell us a little bit about what is it about Missio that's resonated with you as you and probably therefore Jacob's Well have made kind of a journey through theology in the last 14 years.
Well, I think a couple things. One is, for me, relationships are key. And so for me, a lot of these relationships that I'm seeing present in Missio for me started a long time ago in initial connections through emerging church and some emergent village kinds of things. That's where I met Todd at certain kind of theological gatherings. I don't love being in as a church. I just think the nature of what it looks like for congregations to belong intentionally to each other is up in the air. Denominations have been the way that has happened for several years. And I think that they're still really important and significant ways of belonging, but I don't think they're the only way to belong. And so I think a number of us are trying to figure out what does it look like for not just leaders, but churches to belong to each other in intentional ways, and relationships really matter in that regard. And so, so if the first is I'm just really excited about some of the people I see participating, both either by reputation or by my own set of relationships that I've been able to develop over the last decade. The other is theological. I think there's some really important conversations that have been happening, particularly over the last 5 years, about the nature of the gospel. Who gets to decide what the nature of the gospel is, and how big is the scope of the gospel, and what are the frames through which we view and understand, and then more importantly, embody the gospel as communities that want to participate in life and the renewal of all things. And so I think different communities have tried to access that conversation in different ways, and I'm just really excited about what I'm seeing from Missio in terms of letting the gospel be the starting point for this theological conversation, and letting our ecclesiology and our practice develop out of what we understand, the way that we're coming to understand what the gospel is and can be, and how that then affects all kinds of things like church structures, like the way we get embedded in neighborhoods and relationships. To me, the starting point has to be the gospel. And so in that sense, the way that we understand and then participate in God's life, there's just nothing more exciting to me. And that's what I see happening. So important. And I think there are a lot of different spaces where that conversation either has been decided or generous in terms of how the conversation, how that space is hosted for the conversation. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, you mentioned before we started talking that your time in New Zealand had opened up some of your theological reflection beyond what you had seen just living in the States. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, in any community, the conversation gets framed in certain ways. And then as far as you see, there's only certain ways to engage that conversation. Rise between right and left and political spectrums. And sees, you just realize that the issues that we have here are not the same as their communities, that they've got different kind of concerns, and when they use language like emerging, it just means something completely different in that context than it means here. And so for me, just there's a robust conversation happening, and the United States is part of that and driving it. But in some ways, the global theological community and the way that churches are trying to understand what God is up to in the world, it's pretty robust and engaging. And so getting a chance to access that, to put down some of the conversation categories that so hot or connected in the United States, and to begin to think through some different lenses, you just realize it's just more going on than what we maybe have the perspective to. And as a result, maybe some of the things that engage don't have to be engaged in those same kind of ways, polemical.
So what's an example of one of those that being in New Zealand kind of opened that up for you?
Well, I mean, I think this is starting to happen, but, you know, we've just come through an election cycle. And, you know, one of the things, example, my background is as an evangelical. That's the community I came to faith through. That's where I came out of. And there's an association within that community where if your faith is this, then that equals this political. And so as a result, you begin to talk about politics in a theological community, whether or not or not. In New Zealand, there's not the same kind of association with evangelicals and necessarily conservative politics. And so you can begin to talk safely and actually have conversation that's not heated. In addition to sexuality and right kind of issues, poverty and war and these things might be included in a theological conversation about how we vote. You know, in the U.S., it just that can be pretty that can be that those conversations can escalate pretty quickly. More national kind of theological community level, and when you're trying to create conversation space in a local church, those things can be pretty challenging.
So would you say in New Zealand it was easier to have conversations around theology that engaged well with differing views, or was that maybe just the environment you were in?
It's at a theological college, and so
sure.
That's a different environment where inquiry matters, and you know, certainly there was certainly a right-leaning evangelical community there. It was, for example, pro-Israel, and that if you questioned anything regarding Palestinian rights, that meant something was amiss in your theology. Now, it did feel like there was a more generous space in general. And part of the deal, too, political structures matter. There are parliamentary systems. No one can build a government coalition without compromising. Whereas here, you know, you're either this or you're that. There, you might have to build a coalition of three or four different politically, philosophically different groups that have to find a way to build a coalition to govern. And so just this pure ideological purity is not possible. You have to begin immediately building relationships to for things to work. Now, it's for us, you know what I mean? Like, I think we're so given to ideology that at times it overwhelms relational realities.
Yeah.
Before we end up here, one of the books you had recommended to me a couple of years back was A Failure of Nerve, Edward Freeman's book, and it's gone through Ecclesia like wildfire.
It's an extraordinary book, isn't it?
It certainly is. And so basically what I'm reaching for here is you got another one of those.
Wow. Great. Well, can I just reflect on that book for a minute?
Yeah, please, sure. Please. And that was part of my question too. So
I teach a missional leadership class both at an undergraduate and graduate level in New Zealand and then here at the local Nazarene Theological Seminary. And one of the big ahas for me from a young leader to where I am now, and I'm in my mid-40s, is just the reality that while we think so much of what we do as leaders is cognitive or behavioral, the reality is that most of the systems we interact with are emotional systems, and that oftentimes as leaders we are tremendously underprepared and underaware of what it looks like to deal with emotional systems, including our own emotional realities. And so we come into situations and these things behave in totally unpredictable ways and we can't figure out what's going on. And so I think for me, one of the big ahas that Friedman and others have signaled is the emotional realities of systems. They behave in predictable ways, but in order for us to know and guide well what that looks like, you've got to know what's going on. And I think that's where Friedman is so helpful. So, for example, when I moved back from New Zealand to Jacob's Well had been without a senior pastor for 2 years, and they had survived and did really well. But there was also enormous anxiety in the system. And there was about a 6 to 9 month period where things were up in the air. And I couldn't come back and just grab the reins and take it over and be, hey, I'm the founding pastor. Here's how it goes. It had to be a relationship dance where I absorbed the anxiety and I learned how to deal with my anxiety while helping drain the anxiety from the system by being present in a non-anxious way, if that makes sense. And I think a lot of times as leaders, we have tons of anxiety. And rather than figuring out how to deal with it well internally within ourselves and in healthy ways, we transfer our anxiety to the system and then expect the system to deal with us, when the reality is as leaders, we've got to stay connected to our communities, figure out what's generating the anxiety, find out ways to deal with our own anxiety in healthy ways, and then lead in the midst of that. And I think that's what Edwin Freeman communicates really well. In terms of other resources, gosh, you're putting me on the spot a little bit in that regard. I know that...
Yeah, I'm asking you to find a book that's better than Friedman.
That's so what he said. No pressure.
or at least I'd want to give it some more thought.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
somebody who continues to work with the ideas that Friedman highlights that's been helpful for me is a Bowen theory practitioner. I think she's out of University of Virginia. She may be at Georgetown. Her name's Roberta Gilbert. And she takes Bowen theory and she connects it to practice in some ways. She did all her research in congregations. So almost the case studies she does are between either rabbis, synagogues, or churches and pastors. And so she's got a book called Extraordinary Leadership that's really helpful. I think the newest one is called The Cornerstone Principle. Again, it's just thinking – one of the contentions of both Friedman and Gilbert is that if you don't know the theory, you can't put it into practice. So a big part of the struggle for leaders is to know the theory so that you can rightly kind of perceive what's happening and then have some freedom in terms of how you decide to react.
So the when you say you said the Bowen theory, that B-O-W-A-N?
Bowen was a theorist who began to postulate. That's who Friedman's kind of channeling in some way. Relationship theory. And so Gilbert under Bowen and has been a popularizer of some of his ideas through her writing. And again, she's probably got about four texts. I've used Extraordinary Leadership in my classes because I think it describes the way in which kind of relationship systems work and how leaders differentiate themselves from their communities, but also stay in contact. A lot of people do is they either are overconnected to their communities, and so everything that comes through their community adversely affects them, or they react the other way. They say, there's too much anxiety. I'm going to separate myself. And that also creates anxiety. So what Bowen theory postulates is the need to be connected, not overconnected, to the system, so that when things go on, you can provide the kind of leadership that's needed to navigate through that.
Awesome.
You just added to my reading list.
Yeah.
There's so much good stuff. And that's the other thing that's so helpful is I feel like in the early days of leading, I was mostly focused on either kind of theology, which is brilliant. I don't think we can do enough of that, or leadership stuff. And I think the emotional side of how communities develop. I mean, people leave ministry not because they weren't smart, not because they often didn't see fruit, but because of the emotional, relational things. I mean, I've never seen one that doesn't end badly where relationships aren't the primary structure.
Sure.
Way to develop a theology that roots that in the gospel. You know, I think that's part of what it means to be a gospel community is to be emotionally intelligent and healthy as part of the renewal of all things, that we're modeling healthy communities, not where conflict doesn't happen, but where conflict happens in a way that's constructive, not destructive.
Mm-hmm. You wrote Intuitive Leadership several years ago, which was really helpful for me. I'm putting you on the spot again, but are you doing any more writing? You thinking through any other?
Yeah. A number of years ago, I agreed to write in a commentary series that IVP is doing called Resonate, that's trying to bridge academy with the pulpit. And so I've been doing Ecclesiastes for a while. It's not my native it's not my sweet spot. And so it's taken me longer to work on. I'm still working through Ecclesiastes, enjoying it, but also struggling a little bit through it. But no, I'm not, in addition to that, not working on anything, although I have some, I'm kind of gestating a little bit.
Nice.
Nobody's listening. You can tell us.
That's right.
Just our moms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Any other questions, John, you've got?
I mean, I think we're
right up time. Yeah.
We're pushing it time-wise for our target length here. So.
Yeah.
Tell us quickly, what are you talking about at the Missio gathering?
So one of the things I'm doing right now, I'm on the hook to do a couple breakout sessions. One is with Mary Kate Morse about leadership and creativity and power. I think there's a big move in missional kind of church language about collaboration as leadership. And yet I think that raises as important as that is real questions about how authority works in communities. And so we're going to be talking about creativity and collaboration and some of talking about today, authority and how power works in complex systems like churches. So I'm really excited about that. I think it's a really important conversation. The other one is with my friend Keyes Kiesler, and we're going to be talking about the gospel and peacemaking and how that relates to local communities and how we interact with our environment.
Great.
Yeah.
So if everybody wants to find you online, do you do the tweets? Do you do the blog? How can everybody keep up with you?
I've kind of, it's just been a busy year and a half. So my blog, I'm ashamed to say, has been sitting there inactive at tkeel.net. But I'm on Twitter at Timothy Keel. And that's where I can be found.
And what's Jacob's Well's website?
Jacob's Well or jacobswellchurch.org.
Perfect.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Tim. This has been really, really great.
I've really fun to talk to you, and I can't wait to together in April. I think it's going to be an amazing time and just a really robust group of folks. It should be just awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Looking forward to meeting you in person.
Thanks, John. You too.